Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I'm Ellen Feldman. I'm delighted to be in London. I'm always happy in London.
And welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be at Radio Gorgeous.
And you are here to talk about, in the main, your fifth novel, The Unwitting.
Yes.
A portrait of marriage in a political landscape.
You said it so perfectly.
I beat you to it.
Yeah. I was interested, obviously, in the political situation and the moral choices there. But I really found out the more I wrote that I was writing about a marriage. And I always find this with books that, you know, when you start out, you think you know what you're writing about. You have characters, which always come first for me, and you have a plot, and you have scenes or something like this, you know, a narrative. But not until I'm really into a book do I begin to understand what's driving me to write this book, what the quest is. And here it was writing about a marriage and how a marriage works.
And yeah, so there's a story behind the story, which you have to find.
Yes,
always, the primary story and then the real story.
Yes.
That emerges as you go along. It's a marriage in a very particular political climate.
It was America in the decades after World War II, and on the surface, a very calm period. I mean, everybody was glad the war was over and normalcy, although it was called togetherness, then normalcy was after World War I, togetherness, and men came home and all the couples had a lot of children and moved to the suburbs, and it was supposed to be a very quiet life. But a couple of things were going on. One thing was McCarthyism, which enters into the book, which was a terrible witch hunt. And a lot of people, a lot of very good people were caught up in it and didn't work for a long time. And they had to sign, if you didn't sign a loyalty oath, you lost your job. Teachers and librarians were losing their jobs. I mean, it wasn't just the famous Hollywood 10 and that sort of thing. And then following it, you had the CIA. Essentially, they opened a second front. The CIA opened a second front in the Cold War called the Cultural Cold War. And they were going to fight this. They did fight this, not with bullets or bombs, but with words and ideas. And so the CIA was covertly funding a lot of magazines, little magazines, and that's pretty well known in the States. I don't know. It probably is here, too, because there was one Encounter magazine was funded by both MI6 and the CIA. But then you had, this is less well known, and there's a little of this in the book, they also funded a lot of publishing houses. So they were publishing books. There was one book that was a bestseller that purported to be the story of a Russian double agent in the month that he kept a journal, supposedly, in the months before he was captured, tried, and executed. And it turned out this was written entirely from CIA files.
Wow.
So there was a lot of this skullduggery going on. There's a funny part to it is that the CIA spent millions and probably didn't get their money's worth. So how much came out of it, we don't know. But it did subvert. If you're publishing a little magazine or an intellectual magazine, you're supposed to be looking for the truth and writing about the truth. And here, there were a lot of people that were shading the truth for this. And it was amazing how widespread it was. Oh, there are a couple of wonderful, wonderful stories. The publisher of the Washington Post, very important American U.S. Newspaper, was asked by a CIA man how much it would cost him to essentially buy a journalist who would come would go overseas and send back the kind of news they wanted. The publisher said, oh, not much at all, less than you'd have to pay for a good hooker.
Nice.
Yes.
A good hooker.
A good hooker, yeah. And the other story is the head of CBS News, and this is not entertainment, this was news, television news. He got so tired of having to go down to the street to use a payphone to call the CIA that he had a phone installed in his office that bypassed the switchboard. So this was really very,
labeled
very
CIA
yes.
phone.
Yeah. Very widespread.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yet, viewed from, you know, so this was the Cold War, and McCarthyism, what for me was interesting in the book that sort of emerged was that the real screws were put to people after McCarthyism. So McCarthy was sort of exposed as a buffoon.
Yes.
You know, how many communists are here? Oh, there are 25. There are 18. Yeah, he 79. Never decide how many. Yeah. And that's all he could spout. Yes. And he was exposed as a buffoon. However, it was still going on. And it struck me that there are a lot of similarities with the war on terrorism now. And how there's an amorphous enemy, an amorphous intangible war. There are things that they can't tell us, or so they're saying.
Yes.
That they can't tell us, but that we should, there definitely is a threat. We should definitely be scared. And it's for our own good how they're going to, you know, fight it. You know, and soft power. You know, this is, you know, this is exactly, you know, they're still paying, Congress is still paying for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty as soft power, as, you know, positive propaganda.
Yes, yes. And this, and that is known that it's the United States government, but a lot of these were not, it was covert. And it is very much the same, because the idea then was that, yes, the Soviet Union was very frightening. I mean, the Soviets and the West each thought the other was determined to start a war, and neither really wanted a war. But the idea was that, oh, that's a terrifying specter out there, the Soviet Union. And with McCarthyism, and even some of the CIA later, they couldn't tell the difference between a real threat and the liberal who lived next door. And there the analogy, I think, really plays out. Also, the term witting and unwitting. It's very interesting because a year and a half ago, when the hearings about the National Security, NSA, started, they asked the Director of Intelligence, James Clapper, this was a congressional hearing in Washington, if, in fact, the NSA was collecting data on millions of Americans. And he answered, not wittingly.
Wow.
And, you know, everybody thought that this was a joke, but they really mean it. The CIA
it's a
uses
term.
This. It's a term.
It's a
witting,
technical
witting
term.
Is, yes. Is, if you know, it's in, there is a very fat tome of CIA. It's called the CIA Official Dictionary. And they define witting and unwitting. And somebody who's witting knows that he or she is, in those days it was always he, is associated with the CIA, is working for the CIA. And then the people frequently in these magazines, publishing houses and stuff, who didn't know about the connection were known as unwitting. Now, where it gets really dicey is that a lot of people probably knew and chose not to know. For me, it's...
The unlooking.
Yes, exactly. Well, it was morally more comfortable. And also, I think for a writer, this is very close to me, the CIA has never offered me money.
But more's the pity.
Yes, exactly. You never want to believe that people aren't publishing your work because of its own, you know, for its own value, that it's politically, you know, useful.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, I think, chose to think, oh, you know, this couldn't be CIA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the work stands alone.
Yes, exactly.
Well, yes, and your ego wouldn't allow you to, you know,
exactly.
to have started writing it, and,
yes.
you know, and go through that whole torturous process without, you know, without that. On the other hand, okay, witting or unwitting, good work was published.
Yes, yes, a lot of
you know. I'm not saying it was like the work's progress. You know what I mean? It wasn't the WPA.
No,
but especially since it was unwitting in many cases, but it's really hard. These are very tricky moral
very
lines.
Tricky. Yeah. The recruiting line was always, all we're going to do is enable you to say what you wanted to say anyway. We're just going to give you the means, the backing, that sort of thing. I think it really became difficult when, and this happens in the book, when editors began to censor themselves, that nobody came in with a sledgehammer and said, you must not publish that. But it was just, you knew that the CIA was behind you. And they also, it wasn't even just, I want to keep getting the funding, I think. It was simply, well, maybe they're right. Maybe this is better for the West if we, you know, if we don't, you know, we don't air our dirty linen in public. The Soviets, with good reason, really hit America on their racial problems. I mean, they played that up a lot. And as I said, with good reason. I mean, it was a terrible situation, terrible racial situation. And the idea was, we mustn't let the rest of the world see this. We must somehow cover it up. And there were a lot of trips where they sent black performers out to show that, oh, America is terrific.
Happy black people.
Yes, exactly. And there was a real story about the CIA decided that it was very hard to get the movies to go along with this because the movies didn't need money. Hollywood never needs
right.
money. But they finally convinced one screenwriter to write in some black characters who were not slaves or minstrels or servants. They would just be, they wouldn't have big parts, but they'd be the couple who lived next door or something like this, which was fine. This worked very well when it played in Europe and around the world. Southern theaters, in America, Southern theaters would not show the film.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not looking at that.
No.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous.
And so this is a marriage as well. And not only does it make you think about the tricky moral things, and you could see it from both sides, you can see the marriage from both sides as well. And the main character, Nell, finds out later in her life what her husband had been thinking and doing during their time together. It makes you question every single thing in her marriage.
Yes.
Including herself. She doesn't stop that searchlight from going over her own actions and herself. But yeah, it is a very intimate portrait of their marriage.
Oh, I'm glad. I hope so. That's what I was shooting for.
Yeah.
It's very funny. I was thinking about this recently. When I started the book, I didn't know that I was going to have the husband's journal at the end. And I'm not, I just, as I kept writing, it came to me that this was very necessary to show this. That's what I mean about really learning as you're writing what you're getting into. I also did not know the choice that Nell was going to make in that hotel room in Leningrad until she walked into that hotel room.
Wow.
That's one of the fun things about
writing.
Yeah.
So it's a surprise to you as much
as
us.
Yes. I mean, when the character starts telling you what she wants to do or what he wants to do, it's the best part.
Well, and she does have a very clear personality. You know, she is very three-dimensional. Like, we've met her. You know, you've seen that woman. And so therefore, you know, I can see her telling you exactly who she is and what she would do.
She's not a shrinking violet by any means.
I loved, she has auburn hair, a nickname is Red. I loved, there was a moment, just in a literary sense, when she comes into someone from her past and he keeps calling her by her nickname at the time, Slim.
Yes.
And I love that moment, you know, like when you lose a girlfriend to a relationship, you know, when she meets her husband, like, that's it. She's like, I'm this person. I have this is who I am now, you know, and all the past and all the people in it recede, you know, in a way.
Yes. And this is, there's a double edge here because she doesn't want to remember that relationship. And that brings back the intimacy of it.
Okay. Which, because if we talk anymore, we will liable to spoil things for the reader, which I don't want to do. It's great. I have always loved Cold War novels, and this is done, it's like an extension of that for me. You know, it's like John le Carré, if he wrote about us back home.
Yes, exactly.
And included women as personalities. Yeah, that would be surprising. Anyway, but your books frequently, if not always, I would say, starting with Lucy and The Boy Who Loved Anne Frank, Scottsboro, there's a political, historical component. Is that what draws you first? Or because you've done World War One, World War Two, you know, civil rights.
I think what I'm really interested in is the intersection between great historical events or periods and individual lives, and how the historical event or the era affects the individual, and how the individual sometimes, as with Lucy or FDR, affects the history itself, or else just how the individuals, as in Next to Love, how they are affected by this huge, you know, era, event, all of that. And so it is the kind of the intersection of the personal and the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in The Unwitting, there is, you know, the death of John F. Kennedy.
Yes.
And it's something, you know, everyone would say, oh, everyone remembers where they were when John F. Kennedy was shot. And so it's something we feel like we all know. but then seen through how somebody else was living it and was experiencing it through a very different prism of her own personal life and experience.
I was very interested. I'd use the term she became in the book. She became an expert in comparative mourning. Mm. And I found that, I still find it interesting, this public mourning for somebody that we as individuals did not know. It happened here with Princess Diana.
Yes.
And I'm not criticizing people for mourning this way. I just think sometimes for people who have experienced a very personal loss, it can be, I don't know, maddening, painful. It's they're different phenomena, mm-hmm. obviously, and they intersect in strange ways.
Yeah, because when you're going through, you know, say a loved one, you've been in the hospital all night, you've been in,
yes.
and you come out, and everyone's just walking around their business. Like, how can you have a day? How can you be like upset about how your coffee got served? You know, like, don't you?
Yes.
And then also on the other hand, are like, oh, really? You're mourning? Like, this is real mourning.
Yes. You know? No, that's the way she feels. I mean, these people, after JFK's assassination, everybody was saying the world will never be the same and life can't go on. I can't go on. And a few months later, one month later at Christmas, they've all forgotten and she's still torn up.
Yeah. And her life is still
shred. Yes.
You know? Absolutely. Okay. So FDR... World War One, World War Two, post-World War Two. Where are we going next?
we're actually going back.
Ah.
We're going back to the early part of the 20th century with Margaret Sanger and the fight for birth control.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. She's an amazing character. She's a very complicated character, very complicated. And one of the interesting things is nobody, younger people have no idea who she is. I mean, she was pretty important here. Mm-hmm. But there were other birth control advocates here, and there were others in the States, but she really became the leader around the world. She was in India, she was in Russia. And I've done this a couple of times now. The first time I was surprised, the public library in New York City, the New York Public Library, when I'm getting out a book that has to do with her. And I, for the first time it happened, the librarian, young woman who works there part-time after school or something, I'm sure, said, my handwriting is not good, said, oh, Margaret Sawyer or something like this. And I said, no, it's Sanger, S-A-N-G-E-R. And then I looked at her, I said, have you ever heard of her? And she said, no. And I said, well, that's why birth control is legal in this country today. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've tried it on a couple of other young people when I'm getting books, and it's amazing how many have no idea.
Well, and I don't think it even has to be that young. I think if you ask women in their 30s, and even in their 40s.
They have no idea.
Would not know.
The other interesting thing is I have a friend who's an historian, and she's a wonderful writer, and she writes about this period. She's an historian of America, 20th century America, 19th and 20th century. Anyway, she sees Margaret Sanger as the photographs of Margaret Sanger later in life looking very dry and crusty. And
sort of like Carrie Nation.
Yes, exactly. And she was probably one of the most sexually active women of the 20th century.
Wow.
Yes.
And you get fixed in aspic, though.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. She really did. She would hate how she is envisioned
now. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So how does your research, I mean, it seems like you do a lot of research. Is that the lengthiest part of the process?
It's not the lengthiest. It depends on the book, really. When it's something with The Unwitting, I had to do a lot because I didn't know anything about the CIA or how it worked. And in fact, I even interviewed two former CIA men, which was great. One was great fun. One was kind of strange. but the research is, I like the research. With Next to Love, I didn't have to do much because those were the stories I grew up on. And I knew the period through that. I generally start with secondary sources, you know, biographies and histories of the period. And then I get into memoirs, and then I get into archives. And one of the things I love the most is newspapers and magazines. They are just, you know, you can get lost in those. And mm-hmm. they're so much fun. And they really bring the period alive.
I remember, you know, when you used to do research at the library, you used to get newsreels.
Yes.
So that you'd see the entire page of what, you know, and like what was being advertised and what, it really gives you a full picture.
Too. Yeah. There are databases online where you can get what they were wearing, what it cost to buy a hat in 1950.
Mm-hmm. And what the hat looked like.
Yes, all of that. Yes, it's great.
Yeah, it gives you a very, a much more textural experience of the time. So with all this research of the CIA, did it make you very cynical or very, you know, because I think, you know, that comment about, oh, it's cheaper to buy a journalist than a good hooker. I think with the idea of the journalist being embedded in the war zone, we're already bought. I mean, I think being bought is, we've accepted as part of our lives. We sort of expect the slant almost.
That's a really interesting point, because during the Vietnam War, the journalist had a big hand in exposing what was going on over there. And I think you're probably right. Things have changed a great deal since then. And when you say, has it made me more cynical? I think I always was. And about the CIA, because I came of age in an anti-Vietnam era. And when I interviewed two men, and one of them, he's 91 now, and I had sat on a committee with him, didn't even know he was a former CIA man until a mutual friend told me. So before a meeting, I approached him. I said, the friend, am I allowed to know this? I approached him, and I said, I understand that you... And then I stopped dead, because in my mind, CIA was dirty. You didn't admit this. So I said, cooperated with the CIA. And he's a big man. He took a step back, threw out his arms and said, cooperated? I was the Berlin bureau chief.
Wow.
And he was so proud of it. And he had good reason to be proud of it, because he was not on the dirty tricks end. He was an intelligence gatherer. And he was a very, very smart. He is a very smart, liberal, admirable character. But it was very funny. It took me back to the period that I was writing about, when it was still honorable or thought to be honorable.
Yeah.
And the other part of that, when you mentioned the NSA now and what's going on, one of the things that started me looking into this book is that was a time when keeping a secret, to be patriotic, you kept the secrets. Now it's often thought that to be patriotic, you expose the secrets.
Yes.
So that's a real turnaround.
Yes. And that patriotism, as David Sedaris once said, no country sits around and says, we're number two, we're number two. You know? But patriotism has become such a tricky and contentious thing. You know, too much is no good, too little, you're unloyal. You know, it's becomes very, you know, you don't want to be black and white like the Tea Party, you know, or George Bush Jr., either for us or Guinness, you know. It's like, it's black and white, and that's it. You know, it's like, no, it is more nuanced. We live in a global society, but how do we do that? And we do expect surveillance of ourselves. And how do we approach that with our patriotism?
I know that is obviously very difficult. I think that patriotism is on the rise again. I mean, the period that I was writing about, the 50s, it was pretty strong. And then certainly in the States, it waned. But we saw with your EU Parliament elections over here, I mean, it's definitely on the rise.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the rise in the States, and it's on the rise in Western Europe. And it's certainly on the rise in Russia.
Well, it seems like hemlines. It goes with economics.
You know? Yeah, well, there is a theory that it does go with economics,
yeah,
yes.
You know, well, yeah. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Well, that's been my pleasure. It's delightful.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
All right. 2, 3, 4.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring, I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain.
going where the weather suits my clothes. Backing off of the northeast wind, sailing on a summer breeze, skipping over the ocean like a stone. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain, going where the weather suits my clothes. Backing off of the northeast wind, sailing on a summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone.